So, welcome and thank you for joining today's conference. What matters now? Preparing for the post-pandemic world. All audio lines have been muted. Please type any questions you may have into the Q&A box and press send. Questions will be addressed during the Q&A portion of the call. Today's discussion may contain forward-looking statements. All statements made that are not historical facts are subject to a number of risk and uncertainty. Actual results may differ materially. Please refer to ARS's website for important legal and disclosure information. With that, I'll turn the call over to Stephen Burke.
Thank you, Sarah, and thank you all for joining us today. Tom Winnick will be the moderator today, but I wanted to take a minute to introduce him to all of you because he's somebody I've known personally and professionally for most of his 30 years in the business. Tom's been a highly successful senior manager and business development professional at some of the leading asset managers in the world, including Dreyfus Mellon, DWS Scudder, and Oppenheimer Invesco. And we're very pleased and fortunate to have him as part of the team. With that, I'll turn it over to you, Tom.
Stephen, thank you for your kind introduction. As Stephen mentioned, I am 30 years in the business here in 2021. But the big celebration is that ARS Investment Partners is celebrating its founding 50 years ago. So congratulations to Arnold and all my colleagues on this tremendous achievement. Stephen and I are also joined today by Ross Taylor. Ross is a partner and portfolio manager here at ARS, and he will be covering how we are implementing some of the ideas from our outlook into stocks in our focused small cap strategy. As Sarah mentioned, there is a Q&A box on your screen, which will allow you to type and submit questions to us. And we will endeavor to answer all of them on the call. If we don't get to your question, we will follow up with you directly afterwards. The way our call will break down today is that Stephen is going to provide a bit of insight on our most recent outlook and talk through a couple of the points we made there. Then, in keeping with the format of our most recent call, which, thanks to all of you, we received great feedback, Ross will talk to how those ideas translate into names in our ARS-focused small cap strategy. Okay, with that, what I'd like to do is turn to our questions. Stephen, in the latest outlook, you discussed a positive view on the post-pandemic economy for several reasons. But one of those reasons, and one of the important ones, was pent-up demand. Can you discuss in more detail what you meant by that?
Sure. Well, like many, like all of you on the call, we're anxious to get back to a more normal sense of living. And being locked down and the restrictions have certainly put a crimp on how we've lived. And that's led to a lot of pent-up demand from consumers, from corporations, and from governments. I want to take each one of them very quickly. As you can see from the chart here, when the lockdowns hit, personal savings rates skyrocketed in the US. And this is unusual for us. We're a 70% consumer-driven economy. So that spike up, and even though it's come down a bit as things reopen for a brief period of time, that has a lot of savings and a lot of consumer demand ready to be unleashed when we can resume normal activities. And that could be $1 trillion or more of economic activity being made available. If you look at corporations, corporations have a big demand for spending. Sarah, if you could click to the next slide, thanks. Corporate demand is going to be very high coming out of this because of the changes that have been going on in the global economy, whether it's the trade wars, now the pandemic. It's highlighted the need for corporations not only to be more efficient, but also to be more resilient, which means more spending is going to have to go in key areas that are going to allow us to operate better. And then when you go to government spending, and we've talked about this a lot, the infrastructure needs of the United States are still massive. And you saw that in Texas in the last week with their energy problem. You've seen it in California recently in the last year or so with the wildfires. One of the big Paradise fires was caused by a 100-year-old line that should have been replaced 25 years ago. So government has to spend not only on basic maintenance of our infrastructure, but on new areas of need, whether it's on getting broadband access out, improving our digital infrastructure, improving our clean energy infrastructure, and improving our educational infrastructure, as well as the basic physical infrastructure. There's a new report coming out from the American Society of Civil Engineers early next month. And I believe that 4.6 trillion number will go up again. And it just shows you the benign neglect coming through and impacting us. But when you unleash these three areas of spending all at once, and we know there's a proposal for a $1.9 trillion relief program that's going to put money into the system, that's going to be followed likely by a pretty significant infrastructure plan, which could be upwards of $2 trillion. And that's going to create a lot of demand, Tom, and that's going to get us back on a better growth trajectory.
Right. Thank you, Stephen. You've also been and remain constructive on the opportunity to build and protect capital in the equity markets, despite the challenges we're all aware of. Why is that?
Well, there's three reasons, and they're really the basis for our view of equity valuations. And the basis for equity valuations for us are the outlook for interest rates, inflation rates, and corporate earnings, which lead to corporate profits. So when you look at where we are, and a lot of people compare us back to the 09 period, or I'm sorry, the period in 2000, 2001, you can see rates were significantly higher back then and have steadily come down. As rates move up a little bit, as they already have this year, and we expect them maybe to move up a little bit more, that actually changes the dynamic of the equity markets. It makes it more of an earnings-driven market rather than a multiple expansion market, because low interest rates help improve the multiples. But we expect rates to stay low for an extended period of time. Jay Powell at the Fed has told you that they have no interest in raising rates anytime soon. And that's been supported by Janet Yellen as the Treasury Secretary. So we think they're going to work very hard to keep rates low. There is a bit of a battle that will be waged with the bondholders, whether they can actually keep that going or not, but we'll have to see. The second area is really inflation expectations. They've been coming down for decades. And while we're seeing slight pickup in inflation right now, we think that's transitory in nature because a lot of it's commodity driven. And unless we get sustained wage growth improvement, it's going to be very hard for us to have sustained levels of inflation in the US. Not that we can't have pockets of it, but to get back to much higher levels is going to take some time. And if you look at the Fed expectations, it's not for multiple years. So that actually creates a very positive environment for equity. And the last one is corporate profits and corporate earnings. This is a chart of after-tax profits, which has rebounded above where we were at 19 levels, but corporate earnings have not gotten there. So we need to improve the revenue side of things, but our profits are still quite strong. And we think they're gonna remain that way because we believe the corporations can do a lot more to keep their cost basis down and to keep improving their efficiencies, even with the need to be more resilient in how they're operating their businesses. So for those three reasons, we think that you should have a positive outlook for the markets.
Okay, great, thank you. What would you tell clients, Stephen, to focus on that they may or may not be focusing on at this point?
Well, any of our readers for Outlook know we've been big on the digital transformation that's been going on for several years. And what the pandemic did was pull forward that demand by a couple of years. And we've seen it impacting virtually every aspect of our lives. It's not just how businesses operate, but how governments, how our educational systems, all that is undergoing a massive transformation, which means there's massive dollars coming. But what's important for all the talk about the digital transformation, we're just beginning to see the benefits of it. And we're in this second wave, which we think is going to be fascinating to see how we translate. What you've seen for a lot of the news media has talked about 5G as a major solution, and it is an enabling technology, but we've talked about it for a couple of years. But as you can see from this chart, as a percent of total mobile data, it's not going to be a significant percent of mobile data until a couple of years out. So the hype is here right now, but the reality of the benefits of it are still to come. And as people are starting to talk about moving away from technology investments, we think they're making a mistake. Not that there aren't some overvalued stocks in the tech area, there are overvalued stocks in virtually every area of the market. But what we see is where you have opportunities to benefit from all the changes that are coming in technology, and it's going to be across all industries. We think that people are underestimating the impact of these changes that are coming. So that's number one. Number two is the productivity improvements that are going to come about as 5G and the other enabling technologies come in. And that includes artificial intelligence, the full benefits from that, self-driving cars, and the like, what we can do in green energy. That will require us to be much better in 5G because it's going to require the use of much more data. So we think the productivity improvements are on the horizon and will actually help really boost the economy and boost economic activity, not only in the US, but around the world. Productivity is a measure of the efficiency of an economy, as well as it serves as the determinant for the foreign exchange value of its currency. The US has been in good standing there, even though we have had modest productivity improvements over the last two decades. We think we're about to enter a very strong period of it. The other key element with all this technology coming in is that productivity improvements are the antidote for inflation. The better we are at improving our productive capacity, the harder it is to get inflationary pressures because we're doing more with less. And that's going to be a big driver. And we think even though we're having this short-term move up in rates and inflation expectations, when we see the benefits of 5G and other technologies coming through that improve our productivity, that's going to be a big change. And we're already starting to see this. We've seen it in healthcare with the ability for us to come out with not one, but multiple vaccines in less than a 12-month period to get them developed, manufactured, and distributed in that time is one evidence of how we're making productivity improvements. It's particularly important with healthcare being 17% of our GDP, which is twice what most developed nations would be. So that's a big change for us. We've also seen it in manufacturing sectors, autos, for example, where they're able to bring back jobs to the US because we're able to do so much more in a plant with fewer employees that allows us to compete more effectively with low cost, low wage foreign earners and bring back jobs to the United States. We're also seeing it in, we saw it last year, in the ability for millions of workers to go from working in an office to working from home or working from anywhere in a very short period of time. Those are all examples of the productivity improvements that are coming. And you're gonna hear more about how technology is changing when Ross gets into some of the small cap ideas that I'll talk about. So it's for these reasons, Tom, we think people should focus on where we are in the tech cycle and don't focus on the hype, but focus on the reality and keep an eye on the productivity improvements that are coming because that's gonna create some great opportunities in the markets.
Great, Stephen, thank you. Let's turn our attention now to how we're putting these great observations that, again, many of you who have known us for a while, we always have in our outlook, but how are we putting these great ideas that we've garnered from the outlook into actual stocks inside the Focus Small Cap strategy? And with that, we'll turn to Ross. And Ross, we've talked about the impact, and Stephen just talked about it again, that technology has had on all sectors of the market. Would you highlight a couple of our stocks inside the Focus Small Cap strategy that are in the technology space, please?
Certainly, Tom. The first I'll talk about is Immersion. Immersion is a company involved in the development of haptics. Haptics are the physical sensation that one gets from a device such as your cell phone when you get a text or a message in, it might vibrate. They also are used in industrial uses, medical uses, defense uses. It's a fairly broad reach. We see haptics as a great way to play the growth in technology that's gonna happen over the next 3, 4, 5 years. Haptics get involved in everything from gaming to augmented and virtual reality to household electronics, as I said, industrial and medical equipment. And longer term, we think there's going to be a major market for them in autos. As I said, they're that physical sensation that you get from an electronic device. At the high end now, you know, pilots flying by wire actually would get no feedback from the stick. So they actually now put haptics into it to create the sensation that the pilot is getting resistance that he would usually experience if he were flying a push-pull aircraft. A doctor doing microsurgery actually won't necessarily feel what he's doing, but with the use of haptics, it can create the feel. So he has that sensation that he's actually working inside of someone's body, and that sensation comes into his hands where it might not otherwise be. And if you have a kid who plays video games online, you know haptics because they're pretty much what the kids live for in their experience. In the last few years, immersion has undergone a tremendous amount of change. They brought in a new management team, a new board, and that team adopted a new business model. The company's focusing now on generating licensing fees paid on a per unit basis, instead of spending their time and their immense resources on pursuing patent infringements and IP settlements. Today, instead, they're working very closely with the licensees to integrate advanced haptic technologies into the most state-of-the-art products out there. The old business model created results that were very lumpy, as revenues largely depended on the timing of legal settlements or agreements with licensees who might have been in violation of the IP. Getting away from this model has resulted in the ability of immersion to aggressively reduce their corporate expenses. G&A is going to fall by about $1.25 a share this year from what it was 2 years ago because of this new model. And this is on a stock that's trading at less than $11 a share right now. Going forward, we expect that immersion should be able to retain this low level of $17 to $19 million annually in G&A expenses. So that's going to provide a tremendous lever upside for the company and its earnings. Right now, analysts expect immersion to generate about $30 million in revenues in the current year we're in, 2021, and grow at a mid-teens rate going forward. That will take EPS from 5 cents in 2020 to 42 cents by 2022. But we think the street's missing something, and we think things can be a lot better than that. And that something that they're missing is the impact that the Sony PlayStation 5 controller is going to have on immersion. We believe that in 2023, immersion can generate almost as much in revenues from the PlayStation 5 alone as they will generate overall this year. This could mean that the PlayStation 5 alone contributes close to a dollar a share in pre-tax income by 2023 and 2024. And it should be able to sustain at that rate for a number of years past that, as experts currently expect the PlayStation 5 to be able to generate over 200 million units sold over the next 4 years. And for immersion, we think that they're getting 30 to 50 cents per unit sold. So the only real risk to the PlayStation 5 long run is more likely that Sony brings out a new PlayStation, a PlayStation 6, which we would expect to make even greater use of haptics. We also believe that the success among critics and the like of the PlayStation 5 is going to help drive companies like Microsoft and Nintendo to upgrade their use of haptics in their controllers in order to retain market share. The PlayStation product dominates outside the United States, with Microsoft dominating inside the US, but we think that if one is seen to get substantially above the other in quality of play, it runs the risk of running the table. And so we believe that immersion is going to benefit as someone like Microsoft adopts its technologies for its gaming consoles. But the game here isn't just PlayStation 5. We see PlayStation 5 as a bridge that's going to help drive the top line for the next couple of years, as the increasing adoption of haptics in a growing number of human interfacing Internet of Things devices kicks in. The new market we're most excited about, as I mentioned before, is autos, where we expect the increasing focus on cabin electronics to become a meaningful driver to the top line growth for immersion. On the screen here, you see a whole bunch of things that are going to end up actually using haptics. New cars like Tesla is working on a number of these types of things in their newest cars. Because a lot of what's happening is cars go electric, there's no real sensation that comes back to you. And so a lot of what they're needing to do is develop that sensation so you get that feedback from the car that those of us who've driven for a while are used to getting. We believe that the real ramp in haptics and autos isn't going to occur for 3 or 4 years because the auto industry tends to have a fairly slow adoption cycle, but that it is coming and it is going to be very exciting. We are already seeing an increased use in the industrial and medical equipment space, And we also expect virtual and augmented reality to be huge markets for the company going forward. Anything robotic that interacts with a human being is going to rely heavily on haptics to help create the environment, the sensation, and the like that one is looking for. If you think about the idea that I think Sony has a robotic dog out there to be your pet, that relies heavily on haptics. It needs to respond when you touch it and pet it. It needs to respond like a real dog to create the experience. And we think that's going to be something that's going to get much, much broader adoption going forward. So that we are really excited about the opportunity that we see in a company like Immersion. The second name in the technology space is specifically involved in e-gaming and e-sports. It's a Canadian company called Enthusiast Gaming. It develops gaming applications, technology, and content for what we think is one of the most exciting market segments around today, and that's video gaming and esports. Enthusiast's stated goal is to own the fan experience, which it hopes to do through its over 100 gaming and game-specific websites and over 1,000 gaming and gaming-related YouTube channels, over which they live stream gaming content and events. They actually even own a Call of Duty franchise in my hometown of Seattle. A lot of what they're doing is hosting events and producing game-related content that connects fans with esports celebrities and influencers. Enthusiast, which you've probably never heard of, boasts a monthly user base of over 300 people, generating 4.2 billion monthly views. If you think about that, that compares very favorably with Reddit and with Twitter, both of which have about 330 million monthly users. We see esports growing at a compounded annual rate of about 15% or more for the foreseeable future. The company has three operating divisions. It has a media and content division, which focuses on advertising, licensing, and other content-related revenue streams. It has a subscription business, which are paid for web and video content streams. And it has its esports entertainment business, which is where the Luminosity Gaming, the Seattle Surge, and the like are operating out of. But what really makes us excited about Enthusiast is the uniqueness of who they reach. The company believes that they reach 43% of all males in the United States and the United Kingdom between the ages of 18 and 34 at least once a month. Of those who visit, 70% are Gen Z or millennial males between ages 8 and 38. 67, two-thirds of those Gen Z males identify gaming as a core component of who they are. 65% spend 15 or more hours a week gaming or involved in gaming-related activities. And nearly as many, 63%, say that they're influenced by the online ads they see while gaming. And almost half, 48%, don't use Facebook at all, which means that for an advertiser looking to get to this target demographic, not only is advertising on Enthusiast safe, it's also very effective. Evidence of this was that in the last presidential election, the Biden-Harris campaign actually made use of Enthusiast gaming websites when it became concerned that its message wasn't reaching the target demographic that Enthusiast addresses. In 2019, brand spend on esports topped $1 billion for the first time, and that seems like a lot of money. But when you compare it to the $48 billion that's spent on traditional sports, it really pales. And in fact, even the Tokyo Olympics this year will have over $6 billion spent on it. So Enthusiast has a very small share of the potential market to date, but a very broad reach. What we're looking for out of them is for them not so much to expand their reach with 300 million users, visitors. They've got that. What we're looking for them to do is to drive the revenue they capture from advertisers and from users, a statistic in the industry called ARPU, revenue per user. Right now, it's about 33 cents a day, and the company has stated that it hopes to achieve an ARPU of $1 to $3 by 2024, which would lead to revenues of between $2.50 and $8 a share, which we think would drive the stock up substantially. As I said, with Enthusiast having 300 million users, it doesn't take them much other than growing ARPU to drive this stock into being one of the hottest games in town. And I'll pass it back to you, Tom.
Thank you, Ross. One of the silver linings we've seen during the pandemic has been the performance of the healthcare industry, especially, of course, with regards to vaccines. But we found some very interesting investments in other areas of breakthroughs. Can you discuss some of those, please?
Yeah, certainly. We'll talk about two. The first is a company called Neumora, which is a public spin-out of a private company that's focused on developing non-invasive testing systems. The first product they're bringing to market is for the monitoring of glucose levels. They have a CE mark allowing sale in Europe, and they're awaiting FDA approval here in the United States. Along with the testing system, the company developed something that they called ProBead, which combines the non-invasive glucose monitoring with artificial intelligence and a digital subscription service to provide a full spectrum of service and assistance to users. In the United States, there are 34 million Americans who have type 2 diabetes, and 88 million Americans are classified as pre-diabetic. Taken together, that's almost one in three Americans. We expect Neumora to launch both the test system and the service and support package here in the US this year. Their products can be used daily for conditions such as diabetes, or once a week as a way to monitor a condition such as pre-diabetes, or on demand, such as measuring something like lactate after a workout or sporting event, which is a product that they're working on and we'll talk briefly about in a bit. The system requires only a single finger stick before you use it. You stick your finger, you put a drop of blood into the system, and it uses that to calibrate the reader. After that, using a disposable membrane that is placed on the device, which is about the size of the top of your thumb and is attached to your upper arm, it will measure your glucose anywhere from minutes, every few minutes, to every hour or so. It then, and assuming that non-invasively, which I think is pretty cool, it's pulling it through the skin. And then what it's doing is taking that information that it gets and passing it either to an app on your smartphone or to a central monitoring site, which provides a record of readings and feedback on the levels that are being recorded. Neumora is currently in deep talks with a number of US health insurance companies and large corporations who see this system as an important tool into reducing the cost to businesses and insurers from lost workdays and increased healthcare expenses incurred by those suffering from diabetes and pre-diabetes. Outside the United States, Neumora is working with NHS England to bring the system to affected individuals in the UK. The system has been proven through clinical trials both here in Europe, and while the system is currently pre-revenue, we do expect them to announce a number of very important client wins in coming months. This is what we in the investment business call a razor blade model, where they sell the piece of equipment and then make money selling the consumable, which is a new membrane every time you need to use it, every day you use it. We expect that insurers and companies adopting the Neumora system will cover the cost of both the system and the disposables because of the importance of what they're addressing here. After the launch in the US, we expect that the company will launch a direct-to-consumer effort, initially in glucose, but setting it up to push out into other tests further out this year. We already see them looking at, as I mentioned before, lactate, which is something that builds up in your bloodstream and the like when you've exercised, or it's what causes your muscles to be stiff and sore. I remember when I was younger playing basketball, after every practice, we had to sit upside down and clack our legs together in an effort to get the lactate out of our body. With this system, you'll be able to know what your lactate levels are and be able to manage them much more effectively. Another test they're well on the way to having developed is one for cortisol, which is a hormone that builds up when you're under stress. With these two products, lactate and cortisol, we think that Neumora is going to be able to position this product into what we'll call a lifestyle brand, offering a much wider array of tests for athletes, those who work out regularly, or those who are just focused on their wellness. So we see a substantial upside here. And what we're really just waiting for, and I think the stock is waiting for, is just that first big corporation or insurer to sign on. And once they do, we think the candle will be lit on this stock. The second name we have in the medical space is a company called Red Hill Pharma. Red Hill is a biopharma company that develops and commercializes drugs. It currently has 3 FDA-approved drugs in the market for various gastrointestinal conditions. They also have 3 drugs in phase 3 trials, but we're going to pass on talking about those today because after we talk briefly about the 3 already approved drugs, we want to talk about the 2 drugs they have in ongoing phase 2, phase 3 studies for COVID-19 conditions. The 3 drugs currently in the market you see here, it's Talicia, which is for treatment of H. pylori infection. It was launched at the end of February in 2020. H. pylori infections are the strongest risk factor for gastric cancer and peptic ulcers. Eradicating H. pylori reduces the risk of gastric cancer by about 3/4. It's estimated that about 1/3 of the US population has H. pylori, but annually only 2 million patients are treated, in part because the current standard of treatment fails all too often. And it's believed that standard of treatment fails because the disease has grown resistant to the 2 primary antibiotics used to treat it. The second product they have in the market is Movantik, which is targeting opioid-induced constipation, which affects over 40% of patients who are on any extended opioid therapy. That gives it an annual market in the US of about 12 million people, where 71% of the sufferers report little or no benefit from the usual OTC treatment recommended by one's doctor. And the third treatment they have is Aemcolo, which is for traveler's diarrhea, which has been a market that's been hurt by the shutdown in global travel due to COVID-19. But as I said a bit ago, what really makes us excited about Red Hill is the 2 compounds that they have in development right now that are believed to have significant impact and effect for those suffering acute respiratory distress from COVID-19. These are Opaginib, which is an orally administered pill form used in hospitals. It was developed originally to target multiple conditions, including cancer and anti-cancer and anti-inflammatory uses, and demonstrated a potent antiviral activity. This later characteristic caused it to be tried out in humans suffering from severe respiratory conditions linked to COVID-19, where it had significant success in a very small sample. It has since then been tested on bronchial tissue, where it demonstrated an ability to completely inhibit the SARS-CoV viral replication in only 3 days. It also showed much greater impact than any other compound tested, including Remisifir. It showed no compromising of the cell membrane. Therefore, it was believed and has been demonstrated through phase 2 trials to be safe in humans. Those same phase 2 trials showed that it was effective in getting 53% of patients on room air by day 14 off of ventilators onto room air versus 22% in the control group. And almost 3/4 of the patients were able to be discharged by day 14. The hope is that beyond COVID, this compound will also prove effective in a number of other conditions, including pneumonia and flu treatment. The second compound has a complicated name that I'm going to refer to by its number, RB107. This targets the same end markets and diseases as Opaginib, and it's also a pill. This one is targeted for out-of-hospital treatment, and it's seen similar performance to Opaginib in studies using bronchial tissue. We expect that the data coming out of the studies on both of these drugs should be available in, later this spring or early summer. If the studies show results similar to what's already been seen, we would expect the FDA to grant emergency use approval before year-end and for each to become a frontline treatment for those suffering from severe respiratory conditions related to COVID-19. We also believe that these drugs have the potential to become part of the public health go-to response for any future pandemic, given their apparent effectiveness and very low side effects. The public health authorities, we believe, are going to be one area that really changes going forward. In the past, it was a bit of a backwater, and the US primarily focused on things such as sexually transmitted diseases. But going forward, we know that we have to have a much more robust and effective response. They need to have drugs, equipment, and supplies stockpiled and ready for distribution should we have another pandemic. And the fact that the drugs that we're talking about here are both pill form makes it a very interesting opportunity for Red Hill going forward. Back to you, Tom.
Thanks, Ross. We've talked about the pandemic accelerating changes to many industries, leading to a skills gap in employees at various companies. We have an investment in the portfolio that addresses that very challenge. Can you speak more on that name, Ross?
Certainly. The company is a company called GP Strategies, and GP is a training company that works with corporations and governments to impart skills, new skills, at all levels of a company's workforce. They work from everywhere, from the factory floor all the way up to the chief executive officer. Their largest industrial exposure is to the auto industry, but they, as you can see, cover a wide spectrum of industries overall. Their purpose is to develop and hone skills needed by individuals to better do their jobs. As I said, they do everything from going to the factory floor to teach workers how to operate a new technology-heavy piece of machinery, or up to the chief executive's office to try to teach him how to better communicate with his employees and with his stakeholders. We believe that this type of corporate training is going to be essential going forward. Most corporations do their training in-house, or they make use of mom-and-pop operators locally. GPX's global footprint, though, makes it both unique and very valuable in its space. Now, 2020 was a difficult year for GP due to the impact of COVID-19, which caused companies to scale back training both as they tried to reduce negative cash flow and also as they were simply trying to transition their workforce to working remotely. As a result, sales did fall in 2020, but we believe that 2021 is going to see the beginning of a bounce back, both from corporate clients as well as governments. We see top line growth in the high single digits to the low mid double digits in 2021, which we think should drive earnings by 50% or more this year. And we see earnings growing by another third or more next year as sales continue to ramp higher. Historically, GP trained on site, but a few years ago, the company recognized that the internet was going to offer tremendous opportunities to switch to distance learning, and that doing so would help increase their operating margins and efficiencies tremendously. So GP started to put capital and effort and people into building out that distance learning capability. We believe that as people come back to work from COVID-19 induced layoffs, many are going to find that their skill sets don't meet the standards that are now needed, be it in the office or on the factory floor. And many of the low-skilled jobs that previously didn't really need any type of training of this nature are going to be gone forever. And the people in them are going to need to find skills to work in higher level jobs that revolve around much more technological innovation and capability. Thus, we think it's going to be essential for workers to gain and retain high levels of skills and for corporations to make sure that the people they have working for them have those types of skills. For many companies, it's a lot easier to train the person you have than it is to go out and find a new person who might have the skills that you want. We also believe that governments are going to need to help impart the skills and tools needed for those who are perhaps hardcore unemployed to find a place in the new COVID economy, post-COVID economy. We think that, you know, going into COVID, there was a tremendous number of executives we talked to who cited a skills dislocation where their employees, when they were looking for new people, the biggest constraint they saw to growth was the inability to get people who could do the job with the equipment they had and the like. So we think that going forward, things have only gotten more complicated. So training is only going to be more important. On the earnings per share front, we think that GP Strategies, which trades at about $13 a share, should generate over $1 a share by 2022. And that, we believe, will make GP a very rewarding investment for our clients for years to come. Back to you, Tom.
Ross, thank you very much. Well, everyone, that concludes our prepared remarks. We do have a question that was sent in before the call, but I just wanted to remind you, there is a Q&A box at the bottom of your screen. If you have a question, please type it in and submit it. We'd love to answer it. But while everyone's doing that, Stephen, I have a question for you. The question that came in was, what is your forecast for if and when business travel will ever return to its pre-pandemic levels?
That's a great question, and that's part of the pent-up demand answer that we had before. I think the way to look at it is a couple-fold. There's been some surveys out just recently, including one I just saw this morning from travel experts that are suggesting that to get back to normal could take 3 to 5 years. But I would suggest, as we wrote in the Outlook, the normal post-pandemic will not be what it was pre-pandemic. And I think that's particularly the case for business travel. Similar to how offices are not, we're not probably going to go back to 100% office volumes. I think business travel will see a somewhat of a decline in that and take a while to get back to where we were. But 4 out of 5 business travelers today say they would be ready to go back on the road right now. For leisure travelers, it's about 76% right now are ready to go. What's interesting, another study I saw had an increase from January to February of people who would be very comfortable or somewhat comfortable business traveling grew from 49% of surveyed to 57% of surveyed in 1 month period. So we think it's going to take some years for business travel to get back, but we do think there'll be initial pop when the vaccine becomes more fully distributed. One of the challenges is going to be what are the regulations, both by the airlines and also by government, in terms of allowing travel. And we think that domestic travel will take precedent over international travel because of the complications of going outside your borders.
Great. Thank you, Stephen. Ross, a question that just came in from one of the attendees is, we all know what Amazon has done. What impact will their news of Amazon Pharmacy have? And do you feel this opportunity will drive their earnings even higher?
Amazon has been working on getting into the healthcare space for some time. Their latest announcement was interesting to me because everyone focused on the Amazon side of it and kind of missed that the underlying infrastructure Amazon's going to rely on are other drugstores, things already in place, including CVS. It's going to be a major supplier of their stores. So while I think that it will have an impact, I think that for the foreseeable future, this is not going to be a primary driver. Amazon has got, you know, its marketplace is going to continue, I think, to be what we've seen right in here now, which is the number one most important thing they do, surprisingly, is web services. It's a place they dominate, a space they dominate. And second is the e-commerce side. I do think healthcare is an area where they will gain share, but I don't see them taking share as rapidly as many people thought they would. And I don't see them, I see them having to work with people like CVS and things of that nature. I mean, that for a lot of drugs, there are a lot of regulations involved and it's not necessarily as easy to ship and service in a timely fashion. Sometimes getting it tomorrow just isn't fast enough when it comes to a drug.
Okay, thank you, Ross. Stephen, Chairman Powell spoke this morning in Senate testimony about a U.S. digital dollar being a high priority for the Federal Reserve. How do you see this impacting the broader economy in your portfolio selection? I guess that would be for either you or Ross, or both of you, if you have a comment.
I'll take the first part and Russ can jump in. It's been a big issue for central bankers all over, and Janet Yellen's been also talking about it quite a bit. The concern for governments and central banks in particular when it comes to cryptocurrencies and Bitcoin is that it takes their control of the economy away from them because they lose control of the currency if they can't manage it properly. So central banks are starting to look much more aggressively at what they call central bank digital currencies, which would allow the benefits of the digital currency in terms of ease of transactions to occur, but it also stabilizes the price so you have it related to a currency and less volatility there, which is one of the issues with it. It also brings above ground the illicit activities that were being done through Bitcoin if they can shut down the non-government ones. But I think from a broader market perspective, it's a bigger issue for the central banks that they keep control of their ability to manage the economy through interest rates and currency than it will have in terms of growing GDP or anything like that. There are benefits to it that may facilitate certain transactions. But for us, it's really going to be a debate that the central banks have as it crossed $1 trillion on the regular Bitcoins. Central banks have a wake-up call to figure out how they're going to regulate and create the policies that allow them to manage their tasks, which are price stability and full employment. It doesn't really impact full employment, but it may impact price stability. So we would expect more regulations coming this way and more central bank digital currencies being introduced over the next couple of years.
Yeah, from an investment perspective, you know, Bitcoin, we see Bitcoin as very different than a central bank currency. Cryptocurrency. You know, Bitcoin is basically a speculative asset at this point in time. It needs to get to where it has a much narrower trading range and a much greater ability to run transactions. I think some point Visa does 24,000 transactions a second. Bitcoin's current algorithm allows it to do only 5 a second. So Bitcoin is a long way from being a currency at this stage, and its volatility makes it dangerous to use as a currency in most cases. It's one of those things you need to transact quite quickly. We do see a central bank as a different game. And what they're trying to do is can work in the banking system and work in a business-to-business type environment. As I said, in our portfolio there, we do have companies. We actually had sold something a while back that was involved in the banking side of Bitcoin. It did quite well. It did even better after we sold it, or continued to do well after we sold it. But, you know, we have a number of names that are in that space where we see them as infrastructure plays. We're trying to buy people who build out either the markets or the back office capabilities that work with Bitcoin, as well as with other banking systems and things of that nature, electronic banking systems, as opposed to, you know, seeing a real impact from either Bitcoin itself or from a Fed coin.
Okay. I don't know that I see any other questions. Again, folks, if you've got any questions.
There are two up on the board. One is asking how we feel about infrastructure ETFs. And I would say that generally we like infrastructure tremendously. We think it's an area that, you know, as Stephen was saying, needs to be built, needs to be invested in. Pretty much everywhere in the world, particularly in large parts of the US. ETFs are very specific to what's in them. So I'd always say that, you know, we ourselves don't have much investment in the ETFs. We do make use of some of them, and Sean can probably address this specifically. But as an investor, I'd say be very careful when you buy an ETF to know what you're buying, because just because the name says it's what you want doesn't mean it necessarily is what you want. Sean, do you have some thoughts on infrastructure?
Well, that's exactly the points I was going to make. When you're looking at the ETF, the infrastructure ETF, you do have to kind of look under the hood a little. Like, you know, looking at I think the largest one out there, it's about $2 billion in assets. But if you look at the makeup, it's 40% utilities, 20% energy, and 40% transportation. And depending on how you're trying to play infrastructure, we're actually thinking about it. We do run an ETF. Portfolio was actually looking more towards the materials sector and the materials ETF to get the exposure that we were thinking about.
Great. Thank you very much. I appreciate you joining there, Sean. Ross, the other question that we had come in is around GP strategies and how are they protected against competition?
Like pretty much everyone who provides a service, as we well know, you're protected against competition by performing above your client's expectations. One of the ways that they do have protection is they do have that global footprint. So literally they were able to be used as a global banking, a major banking company that's used them, because they can deal with people in Asia and deal with people in Europe and deal with people here in the US as well, and have an integrated training process, which otherwise is complicated and difficult to do when you're doing it through a collection of mom and pop or regional operators, and which is much more cost efficient. One of the things they actually do is they share in many of their new contracts, they actually share cost savings. So their job is to achieve a performance result with the employees they're training and to do it at a lower price than the in-house test training was being done. And they found these to be very lucrative contracts for them because they are able to use their larger footprint and experience to actually go in and run a much better product. So you know, their entire business model is on delivering superior training to the clients in an effective manner that produces measurable results in the workforce. And they found that to be a successful product for them and a successful niche to have carved out.
Great. Thank you, Ross. Well, that's all the questions that we've had come in. Thank you all very much for joining today's call. If you have any questions about anything that we've covered on the call, please don't hesitate to reach out to us. Also, if you have any interest in, again, the strategy that Ross had talked about, and we believe that exposure in small caps is important in anyone's asset allocation, please don't hesitate to reach out to us about the ARS focused small cap strategy. With that, Stephen, Ross, thank you very much. Great job. Sean, thank you for your cameo appearance there. And everyone, stay safe out there, and we'll talk with you soon. Take care.